Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. True stories of the mob skimming from the Las Vegas casinos in the 1970s. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. Highly sought after speaker for college, corporate, and service organization programs. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. We must pay the studio time and Freedom of Information Act requests that we filed with the federal government. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Please subscribe to this podcast and review the show. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Thanks, Aaron. It's good to be here. And actually, I'm a lawyer, too. Don't forget that. Somebody might need a traffic ticket out there. You know, tonight, I'm going to change up a little bit, and we're not going to talk about La Cosa Nostra in Kansas City. You know, we've been talking about La Cosa Nostra in Kansas City, and we'll talk about it again. But I want to describe another responsibility of the Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit. You know, I was assigned to the Intelligence Unit for 13 years. And we were mandated to investigate and document mob stuff, but we were also mandated to investigate any group that threatens to disrupt the peace. And the Ku Klux Klan was certainly one of those. And tonight I'm going to talk about investigating the Klan. You ever heard of any Klan members in Kansas City, Aaron?
I've never heard of the Klan. I mean, I've heard of the Klan, but never like Klan members in Kansas City.
Right. They're pretty low key. Let's go back a little bit. I want to give you a little basis for the Ku Klux Klan. A lot of misinformation out there, and it's still around. A lot of the modern permutations, shall we say, of the Klan, or we'll talk about later, the White Aryan Resistance and the Nationalist Socialist Parties, which are Nazis, and the skinheads, the racist skinheads. The Ku Klux Klan really began, as most people know, when newly freed slaves were asserting their right to vote.
That was in the 1800s.
That was back in the 1800s, right after the Civil War was over in 1865, and black folks got the right to vote. And in the South, that scared the heck out of the white people. But they couldn't do anything about it. They tried, and when they tried to stop black folks from voting and asserting any other civil rights, like you, a black man or black woman could not testify in a trial, even if they were the suspect, the victim or the defendant, they couldn't testify.
This was before, or just after the Civil War, all of these things changed.
Yeah, right after the Civil War, all this changed, and so. As the Confederate soldiers came back and they took over the positions of power, but black men could vote. Well, now black women couldn't vote, but white women couldn't vote either. So when they started voting their own people in, and white people started using violent tactics to prevent them from voting, using violent tactics to intimidate them into not taking part in the civil process. And the federal government passed something called the Enforcement Act of 1870. And they had soldiers during Reconstruction. They had soldiers in the South until 1877. So there was a lot of prosecutions of these guys, and they formed up this secret society. And Nathan Bedford Forrest, I think, was the name of the man who formed this secret society called the Ku Klux Klan. And I'm not going to go into what all that means. I don't think it's really important. It's taken on its own meaning. And, you know, they had vigorous federal prosecutions in the 1870s, and they pretty well eradicated it.
But yet it persisted.
It persisted. It still was on the down low. And by 1915, there was a new popularity, and it was all over the eastern part of the United States, because at the turn of the century, you had not only black folks in the South were wanting to vote and hold office and have jobs and be paid and not be slaves anymore, so to speak. Why, you had all these strange-looking immigrants. And by then, Irish people had gotten here, and they're white, and they had pretty well moved into city government jobs and opened businesses. And since they looked so much like the existing French and English, primarily English people, why, they were accepted in. And then you had Italians who were darker and spoke a different language and dressed differently. You had Jewish people from Eastern Europe, especially later on up in the 30s and 20s, fleeing Nazi Germany. And they just spoke a different language, and they looked different, and they talked different, and they even had a different religion. And you had other Eastern Europeans, Polish people, coming here for jobs and opportunity, and a lot of them were Catholic. And the Klan really had a rebirth, and it really kind of pitted these urban-dwelling, newly arrived immigrants against rural America, because they were threatened by it. And it really was a lot of Klan activity against Catholics, because they were different. They weren't Protestants. The Klan preached things like 100% Americanism at the time, and they demanded...
Yet they were immigrants themselves.
Oh,
at some point. But they were not Native American.
Right. They'd been here for a while. A lot of them had been there since, you know, the late 1600s and the early 1700s. So they felt like they were the Native Americans. Even some of them had only been here a couple of generations, and, you know, just before the Civil War or right after the Civil War. But partly they were white. They were European descendants. They were Germans and Irish and English. And so these Irish and they were Protestant except for the Irish. And but these newly arrived Italians were Catholic, and a lot of the Eastern Europeans were Catholic, and they were darker, and they definitely spoke a different language. Jewish people were, you know, there's always been persecution of Jewish people. That's why they ended up here. So this really got the Klan going again, and that there was a lot of lynchings. That's when the big-time lynchings were, was in the 1930s.
Was the Klan largely then still out of the South and the eastern part of the U.S.?
Well, that's when they started moving out of the South, and they moved up in the East and the Midwest, and they never really moved west, but they moved up into the Midwest, and it got more popular, and even up into Indiana and Ohio and Illinois and places like that. World War II came along, and you know, everybody was preoccupied by World War II. I hate to give too much of a history lesson. People will be going to sleep on us, but World War II came along, and there really wasn't much Klan activity, and everybody pulled together during World War II, kind of like right after 9/11, where we're all pals against the Arabs. But, you know, the civil rights movement in the 1960s, after these black soldiers got back and they realized that they had been denied the right to vote, there was very few black people voting. In the early 1950s, there was hardly any black people voting. Where there'd be a black majority in a southern county, there might be, you know, five people signed up to vote. And they were the good, the Uncle Toms that everybody trusted. But the majority of the black people couldn't vote because they had... like you'd have to recite the entire Constitution in order to pass the test, in order to be able to vote.
You mean they actually had a different test for black people?
They had a different test for black people
than they did for white people.
Correct.
No, but a lot of these, because as the soldiers that would come back from World War II, African American soldiers, originally they worked in completely separate units and much more demeaning positions.
Correct.
But didn't by the end of the war, there was a lot more integration into the armed forces?
Well, that's when it started, really, was World War II. There were several, like the Tuskegee Airmen, and there was I read a book about a tank battalion of all African-American soldiers. And so, you know, the need for fighting men was so great in World War II that they the white majority even deigned to arm and outfit
and train
all black groups, and they proved themselves, and they more than proved themselves. And when they came back, you know, they came back to the same old stuff. Here they'd been fighting for the right to vote and for freedom and the American way, and they come back to, you know, oh, boy, get off the sidewalk. Hey, boy, you know, no, you can't vote, boy.
At that point, they couldn't even use the same restroom still.
Couldn't use the same restrooms, couldn't eat in the same restaurants.
Couldn't ride at anywhere in the bus but the back.
Correct. So, you know, that's when the civil rights started, was really out of these returning vets. And they'd had enough, and they'd paid their dues, and they felt more of a part of America, and they started organizing. And as we all know, we won't go back over the civil rights movement, they made a great inroads into it. It's you know, one of the, probably of the 20th century, it's the greatest story of anything, Martin Luther King and nonviolent I can't even think of the word.
Nonviolent means of protest,
and it really worked pretty well.
Well, this must have really frightened the local white population, if you will.
It terrified them, and as a kind of a, talking about the Klan and what they did.
I mean, did they actually? They would target civil rights leaders,
sure,
wouldn't they?
Sure, they killed Medgar Evers with a sniper rifle, and they bombed that church down in Montgomery, Alabama, killed four little girls.
Was that blamed on the Klan?
Well, these, you know, it's hard to say whether somebody's actually a card-carrying member of the Klan or not. It's such a amorphous, you know, this white power right-wing kind of a groups. They come up with one name, and everybody maybe belonged to the Klan at one other time, but then they'll take on some other name and some more radical splinter group inside of a Klan or a Clavern, as they call them.
But as we're talking about this, really, you're really kind of in what would be the third era of the Klan.
Correct. Good point, Aaron. The third era of the Klan, and they really were organizing and had a lot of political power and the legitimate, that's what's important about it, Aaron, is legitimate government officials may not come out in front and say they're Klan members, but they would support them because they wanted to stay off the rolls. They wanted to stay below the radar. And you know, like in Mississippi, for example, they had something called the White Citizens Council. And these were just, it was a quasi, what we would call today a non-governmental organization or an NGO. It was a kind of a quasi-governmental organization whose job it was to go out and gather intelligence on these agitators that were coming down out of the north to stir up their local black folks. And they had kind of a government a stamp of approval, local government, state government stamp of approval.
To go in and gather intelligence on.
Correct. And
what they were doing to organize in the civil rights movement.
And these were all Klans people. You know, we just use the word Klan really as almost a generic term to cover all these white power groups. We'll get more into the detail of some different names as we get on in this story. And this one particular incident in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and it's a La Cosa Nostra story involved with this also, but there were three civil rights workers, two white and one black, Andrew Goodman, James Chaney, and Michael Schwerner, and they had been stopped by the Philadelphia City Police. I took all three of them in and had some kind of a trumped-up traffic charge and took them into the city jail and held them there for a little bit. And you know, in retrospect, we find out now why they held them there for a little bit, so they could get some other people together and ready.
So that when they released them,
they released them and they were ready. And these guys start driving out of town and they're pulled over again by the police. Only this time, they're not taken to jail. This time, they're just taken out in the woods and killed. And they buried them, buried their bodies underneath a pond dam. This just been three black guys from down the south. I doubt the Bureau would even, they just said, oh, that's a local crime. That's a local murder. That's nothing to do with us. But
didn't they make a movie about this, though?
Oh, yeah, Mississippi Burning.
Yeah.
So the FBI, they're not having much luck. Now, they didn't show it this way in the movie, but they had a guy named Gregory Scarpa Jr. who was known as the Grim Reaper. He was a mob guy, and he was also what we call a top echelon informant for the Bureau, and they contracted with him to go down to Philadelphia and help solve this by whatever means necessary that he could use. So Scarpa, he's going to make some money and make some more friends with the FBI so he can get out of some more crime up in New York and Philadelphia, the Northeast area. And he goes down there and he kidnaps a Mississippi Klansman named Lawrence Byrd and he tortures him, just like in the movie.
But they couldn't actually do that because they're the FBI.
Right,
but they could work with an informant.
You could, I've been there.
Who operated on their behalf.
You just tell an informant, here's what I want, and don't tell me any details.
But would they even give the informant the name of Lawrence Byrd?
Oh, yeah, sure. He'd say,
so
here's,
they would
here's,
say, here's who we want to get. Here's who we think.
Here's some names
here's
that
you
want
to get.
Sure, Aaron, you got it right. There's a guy, you know, there's this guy, there's this guy, and there's this guy. You might try one of them and see what they're up to. They may know something. And Scarpa would know what that meant, and you know, he'd know what to do. So.
Well, that's why they called him the Grim Reaper.
The Grim Reaper, yes. And he tortures this guy and sticks a gun in his mouth and whacks him around. I don't know all the details. Nobody will ever know the details. And so that guy reveals where the bodies are buried and who did it. But, you know, I remember as a kid, these three policemen, Mississippi Highway Patrol, not Highway Patrol, but county sheriffs and a local police officer, wearing their uniforms into court. And the court was just a joke. Everybody was laughing, and they gave them, like, some kind of, they found them guilty, but gave them some kind of a really short prison sentence, and you know, they just walked on it. They basically walked on it. Even in front of the entire nation, they walked on it.
Well, there were local authorities involved.
Correct.
How could they? They just ignored the fact that the police had. I mean, obviously, yeah, there was a record that they were arrested.
Yeah.
Then they were released.
Yeah.
And so there was no record that they were then pulled over again.
No. They didn't make
they
the
just
case that way.
Used the facilities that they had, if you will, the car, the uniform.
Right.
To do it without documenting it.
Correct.
Which you couldn't hardly do today.
Well, some people would be more suspect of the police today, but
they would
no.
turn the recorder off.
Right, they'd turn the recorder. That's what people would say, but no, I don't think it would happen today. But strange things happen sometimes out there, and you got a lot of different people involved. But I like to think it would never happen today, but it did happen then, and that's how egregious it was in the South for black people, and that's what the Klan was capable of. The Klan was the kind of the motivating, overarching group for all these white power people down in the South and all over
the United
States.
They were willing to do bombings.
Right, right.
And murder people.
So, you know, we turn in the 70s, and there's a huge amount of pressure the Bureau has put, and finally black folks are getting the right to vote. They're becoming elected sheriffs. They're equal opportunity laws, they're becoming state troopers and local policemen and usually the larger cities, not the smaller cities, but the larger cities, and except for the smaller cities that has a large black voting population, then they're becoming the policemen there. But the Klan changes, and they kind of, you know, they die down a little bit because there's not so much fear, and people are getting with this civil rights thing, and black men aren't running around raping all the white women like they claimed they would be if they gave them the right to vote and let people go to school. But school was another place that then the Klan had a little resurgence. But when it came back, and kind of all over the large cities in the United States, they really never came back big and public. They started modernizing, and there's a man named David Duke, who a lot of people have heard of, and he was, at one time, he was supposedly the Grand Kleagle of all the Klans of the United States, and then he turned that over to a guy named Tom Robin. These names aren't too important. Everybody's heard of David Duke, and he was
elected. He was a public official.
He was elected. You're right, Aaron. And if you remember, he was elected a congressman in 1989. And if you also remember, he was slim. He was well-dressed. He was an attractive guy. He was not what you think of as a Klan's member down in the South at this point in time.
Somebody from the Dukes of Hazzard.
Right, right. Loud, beer-bellied, you know.
Obnoxious,
wearing a
uneducated.
White, uneducated, not able to speak very well. Well, David Duke could speak well. He was college-educated, and he was slim, and he dressed well. And he ran for governor, and he won 55% of the white vote in the 1970s as an avowed Klansman member.
And became the governor of St. Louis? Of Louisiana?
No, he did not. He got 55% of the white vote. He didn't get 55% of the vote. But he did get well over half the white vote, uh-huh. And they get none of the black vote, so that didn't put him over to win. But he did become a congressman out of Louisiana for a while, he still runs a bulletin board today, a internet bulletin board. It's called Stormfront. If anybody wants to go out there, I don't want to promote the Klan, but if you want to see what they're capable of and what they talk about, go to Google Stormfront. And this website describes itself as the voice of the new embattled white minority. And if you think the things that are going on in the big cities today, there are a lot of white people, particularly young white men, that feel that they've been left out by society and that black men are all getting their jobs because of equal opportunity, and they're now becoming the minority. So it continues, and it's something we always have to be aware of in ourselves, is our own potential for prejudice and fear of somebody other than ourselves.
Well, the demographics of the United States are definitely changing.
Sure.
Obviously, there's African-Americans, but there's a lot of Latin Americans, Mexican Americans, immigrating, whether it's legal or illegal. A lot of immigrants from other countries, third world countries, coming here to escape, whether it's poverty or war or famine.
Sure. I mean, Kansas City, you go over to the Northeast in Kansas City today, and you'll see people wearing native Arab headdresses and robes, and people obviously fresh here from Africa, and half the signs on Independence Avenue are in Spanish rather than English. So, especially the lower class, poor working white man is terrified of all this competition, and they feel like that they're, because of our sins of the civil rights era and back to the slavery days, black people and people of color be given a leg up. They feel like, and so it's it's still brewing today. We need to keep them aware of it. Now, let's get on to Kansas City a little bit. We had a guy in Kansas City. He worked up at TWA as a hydraulic mechanic. And they had at that point in time, TWA had a big overhaul base, because a lot of you people out there are younger, and you don't maybe remember the TWA overhaul base. But that was a great place to get a job in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. and a good company to work for. You got free airfare all over the world for yourself and your family as a perk, as well as it just a good union job. So his guy's name was Dennis Mahon. His brother, Alan, twin brother, Alan Mahon, worked up there also. And I think they lived down by Parkville and Northmore, maybe, and just south of I-29, or south of the airport, right off of I-29. He was involved with Klan activity, and he was involved with David Duke's group. And David Duke had gone a little more mainstream and was not preaching any kind of violent action, and Mahon, he liked the action. He believed in more direct action and achieving the ends of the Klan, of the white power movement, maybe via violent activity, certainly with more in your face kind of rhetoric. For some reason, he had some connections in Oklahoma, and he started, when he broke with Duke's Klan, and he started his own Klan movement in Oklahoma, and he started one in Missouri at the same time. I think he commuted back and forth. I'm not sure exactly why this happened this way, but he started the Oklahoma White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and then he started the Missouri White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. At the same time, he got involved with a guy out of California who had something called the White Aryan Resistance, or WAR. Ran by a guy, an old-time white power proponent named Tom Metzger. And Tom Metzger had a son, John Metzger. And John Metzger, his job was to go out among young people who, there was a movement of racist skinheads at the time, and they had their own music. And we'll play a little bit of that music later on. But this was kind of what was happening as the Klan morphs and changes and the white power movement morphs and changes. And Mahon also got involved with what we call the used to be the American Nazi Party, a guy named George Lincoln Rockwell. But that kind of fell out of favor, and they have a Nazi party today. You can find it. They have their own website, I'll probably run across that later on, let you know. But it's called the Nationalist Socialist Party. Last Klan rally we had in Kansas City was a bunch of members of the Nationalist Socialist Party.
So the Klan itself, while it had its own sort of agenda, because it was had similar interests to the people from the Aryan Nation.
Correct. The Aryan Nations was part of it too. Reverend Robert Butler out in Hayden Lake, Idaho, they were connected to them too. All these white power groups were loosely connected in some manner, and many people like Dennis Mahon would start their own groups, and they would hold memberships in the Klan in the Identity Church at Hayden Lake, Idaho, and the Aryan Nations and White Aryan Resistance and the Nationalist Socialist Parties and a variety of things, but they all coordinated and communicated and worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the modern day Klan. You don't really see the Klan so much out in the robes and everything, or hearing people talking about the Klan.
Burning crosses.
That's become passe, and that draws a lot more heat. Now you've got the White Aryan Resistance, and so at the time, cable TV in the 80s, and that's what we're going to get to in Kansas City, was a cable TV show. Cable TV shows were cable TVs. Networks were forming all over the United States, and they formed first in California, as usual. And this Tom Metzger is out there. He developed a talk show format, and all cable networks, when they're granted a license by a local political entity. In Kansas City, it was Kansas City, and they granted a license to American Cablevision, for example. Johnson County out there, they have a different Cablevision company because they have granted a license to operate, because you can't have four or five different cable companies operating, at least at that time. It's changed. I understand this is old hat to young people out there. But at that point in time, you only had one cable network in a geographic and a political entity.
But one of the elements of the cable network's development was that they had to provide and grant to the public.
Correct.
Some use or access to the cable system to broadcast their own programs.
Do their own programming, and that's the way it was in Kansas City. They said, okay, we'll grant you this license, but you have to dedicate one channel and a studio and training for local people who maybe want to put on their own show. Now, they didn't foresee the Ku Klux Klan would want to put on their own show, and so Dennis Mahon saw that, and he thought, that would be a way to get my message out, my white power message. He looked at Tom Metzger, had already done that in California, and Tom Metzger had a series of, it was a talk show format, an interview show, and Metzger would be the interviewer, and he would have other white power racists, mainly out of California in the western Hayden Lake, Idaho, the Reverend Robert Miles and Robert Butler, people like that.
On his guests.
So,
and they wouldn't hide their identities?
No. Everybody was out. They were just asserting their political rights, freedom of speech, and you know, as long as you don't shout fire in a crowded theater, well, you can pretty much say whatever you want, unless you're on television or the radio on the airwaves, and you got the seven words that you can't say.
But they were still preaching their violence.
Correct,
and their...
Correct. You know, I got a little clip from that Race and Reason there, Aaron, in that KKK file that I gave you. Why don't you play that and let people hear a little bit about what they say.
Now, in the past, you have been a leader of the United Klans of America at one time.
Yes,
in Michigan,
right.
And you were quite influential in the campaigns of George Wallace.
Right.
And so you're not a newcomer to so-called right-wing causes. Are you a right-winger today?
No, because I think that would be like asking a Frenchman, is he a supporter of a Bonaparte family? That's something in the past. There is no right wing. It is dead, it is buried, and it is where it belongs in history. We are racial revolutionaries. We believe that our race is our religion, and it's our nation. And the sooner that the federal government understands that all we want is to be left alone, leave us alone. Don't tell us where to send our children to school. Don't use our taxes to have us murder brothers. Don't keep putting your devil laws upon our back.
You know, it seems like today in the United States there's many, many people who would agree with that from various racial backgrounds, religious backgrounds, and so forth. But as the United States becomes more occupied by so many ethnic and religious ideas, it seems to be balkanizing, breaking up, and it would seem that the central government is bound to be losing control. And do you see that as a good? You probably would see it as good, but what do you think about
that? If there could be a natural law passed that would limit all nations to 30 million people and no more, I would be the first one to vote for it. The United States is in a transitory condition. It will be an entirely different nation within 50 years. It will be many nations, not one.
Do you believe that these nations will be formed along racial lines?
Along racial lines and along economic lines.
Now, when was that, if you will, that clip was from when?
That was probably 1987, 88, I would say. It was in California.
So about 30 years ago.
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah, about 30 years ago.
And he
ago.
Said within the next 50 years?
50 years, something like that. Well, we're getting close.
The country's going to divide and...
Of course, he would...
On racial lines, yeah. Which...
And he would also limit each country to 30 million people, which, you know, he'd have 30 million white people is what he'd have in his country. But, you know, that's, you know, it's kind of eerie hearing him say that and talking about the right wing. We talk about the right wing today.
But that was actually, that was Robert Miles speaking right. On the show Race and Reason.
Correct. And the host was Tom Metzger. He was
Tom,
the one who
Tom
was,
Metzger.
He was, and the name of his group was the White Aryan Resistance. And you know what's interesting? That Robert Miles out of their and Robert Butler out of their Hayden Lake, Idaho church, the group formed called the Order. And a lot of people have heard of the Order. They went totally underground and started robbing banks out west, and finally got caught. They were a true domestic terrorist group.
Well, these organizations kind of have to fund their activities somehow.
Correct, and they got a lot of poor people in them who really don't have that much money to give anyhow, and your big philanthropists aren't going to give them any money, so...
They do, they have, like, membership dues if you're actually in the organization? I know I was reading on Wikipedia has a Ku Klux Klan page, and they said the organizations in the 20s and 30s they supported it by selling the costume.
Correct. They sold costumes, and they have collected dues, but it's hard to keep up with that. It's an underground organization. You just have a few people who are really involved, and so it's really hard to keep up with somebody paying dues, and they just, most of them have jobs, and this is a part-time thing for them, actually. It's just like this Dennis Mahon. He always worked at TWA till he finally got fired, but... then he worked at somewhere else. I can't remember. He moved to Oklahoma. We'll talk about him more later. But anyhow, so it's 1987, and American Cablevision has this contract, and Dennis Mahon and his brother, Alan Mahon, they don their full Klan regalia, robes and hoods.
Yeah, here in Kansas City.
In Kansas City. Dennis has taken on the title of Imperial Dragon of the Missouri Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and his twin brother is the Exalted Cyclops of the Missouri Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And so they march up to American Cablevision headquarters in their full regalia and demand a show on Channel 20. Was the channel, actually. It was the number of it. I'll never forget that. And of course, American Cablevision doesn't know what to do, so they defer to the city, and the city says, well, you can't do that. And Mahon, if you remember, he didn't want to put on his own show. He didn't want to make a show, create a show. He just wanted to get a videotape of Race and Reason, the show we just heard, and play that in
that.
Kansas City. Now, you know, if you remember, Manuel Cleaver went on to be mayor as their first African-American mayor, and he was on the city council at the time. And I was looking back at old newspaper articles. I noticed that quoted him saying... Councilman Cleaver says, you know, my problem is I never saw this. I don't see this as a First Amendment issue. I see this as a terrorist organization attempting to use the airwaves to create an atmosphere where terror could thrive. I felt they were just trying to plant the seeds. And you know, Manuel Cleaver, he had a cross burned in his yard when he was running for city council. And nobody ever took credit for it. Nobody was ever arrested. It might have just been some neighborhood kids who thought they were having fun. But he did
but
have.
Somebody did.
Somebody did. Somebody burned a cross in his yard. And he was adamant. And they had city council meetings, and they argued about this. And so finally, the city just said, you know, no, we're not going to allow you to do that. And so the Klan, of all people, and you know, if you remember, this happened when the Nazis wanted to march in a primarily Jewish neighborhood in Chicago in Skokie, Illinois. In the suburb of Chicago, and it was primarily 90% Jewish neighborhood, and the American Nazi Party applied for a permit to have a parade, and they refused them. And the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, of all people, are usually, you know, supporting anti-Klan things and supporting poor people. Took that on up there and won them the right to have a parade permit and have their parade, which went off without incident, if you remember. Well, they took on this case. As a matter of fact, I was talking to a friend of mine that's involved in that, was involved heavily in that at the time, and we'll talk about him later, Leonard Zeskind. And Leonard said that ACLU really didn't tell anybody. They just all of a sudden appeared at this court one day with this lawsuit for an injunction and a declaratory order from the judge saying that the city had to allow them to film their own show. So
now somebody must have contacted the ACLU, right, asking them for the help.
Sure, Mahon did. Dennis Mahon. I would have. I'm guessing. We don't really know for sure, but you know, lawyer-client privilege and all that. But I'm sure Dennis Mahon just got hold of him. I doubt they volunteered to do it. But good question. Yeah, how did that happen? Did they get on the phone? I think David Goldstein.
Were they just
Goldstein
reading the local newspaper or watching the case
yeah,
files?
Right.
Where was this? This wasn't necessarily a national issue.
It wasn't
when
national,
the city said, "Hey, we're not going to let this show air."
It was a huge local issue, though. It was on. It was in the headlines every time they had a public anything public about it, the reporters could find out about. They were talking about it, and the Klan trying to have a local cable TV show was a big issue. So I don't know how. I would imagine that Mahon probably called Tom Metzger or somebody, and they said, "Well, get hold of the ACLU. That's a First Amendment right. That's they're trying to stop you from political speech, and we just in this country, no matter how distasteful we find political speech, we cannot use a governmental agency to prevent that speech from happening in a public place." So they take it on. They file a suit. They go to court, and guess what? They're going to be able to put, I'm going to order that they can put on a TV show, but they can't play the tape of Race and Reason. They have to create original programming because that gives them their right to free speech, and it also fits within the rule of about what people are allowed to do in the public access channel is create their own show and put it on.
Well, and it's create your own show in the market you're in, and Race and Reason was out of California.
It was out of California, yeah, that's true too. But I think it was about having original programming, which meant that the local Ku Klux Klan had to come up with an idea, train people on how to use a camera, mm-hmm. train people on you know, using a mic and getting up in front of a mic, have a script, have some creative idea on how to do it. It's like your show, Aaron. I mean, you just don't step in one day and start doing that show. And so you have to create, you know, an idea. How are we going to do a talk show format? Or are we just going to do a rant? Or are we going to have guests?
Because they were giving them like 30 minutes.
Yeah, they're giving. I think it was 30 minutes. I think you're right. Or 15. No, I think it was 15. But be that as it may, even a 15-minute show, I mean, you know, take an untrained person and just put them in front of a microphone for 15 minutes and say, do it. You know, what are they going to do? You know, so they had to create it, which caused them to, you know, get in other people to help them with it. And actually, I think the city truly believed, and I would have believed, they would just drift away then. They would not create their own show.
But they did.
Never underestimate Dennis Mahon. He was a go-getter and continued to be a go-getter. Well, we'll talk about Dennis later and the next week and the next week after that, maybe, or the next show after that. I keep saying a week. These aren't particularly
weak. Well,
all
of this kind of revolves around the fact that some events occurred here in and around Kansas City with the Klan.
Well, they're going to be happening. There's not, you know, at that point in time, Aaron, there's not much going on. There's a few young guys up north of the river. There's a guy in Northmore. They call him just the leader of the local leader of the Kansas City branch of the Ku Klux Klan, Kliegel. I think he was the Kliegel. But anyhow, and then they had two or three young guys out in Belton. They had a couple guys out in Western Wyandotte County, And there were all these disparate, separate people that didn't really know each other, except mm-hmm. the ones that lived in the same neighborhood. And they kind of got together. And
well, they having rallies like they would in days of old, if you will?
No. I mean, they had little meetings. Mahon'd get them together for meetings up at his house once in a while. But they'd contact each other on the telephone, and they knew each other. And mm-hmm. There would be rallies like... one of the guys that came up from Oklahoma, one of the skinheads, I found out that Dennis Mahon had met him at a skinhead rally. Skinheads used to do rallies around the skinhead punk rock music at the mm-hmm. time, and they had a white power agenda. And so, they'd get together at these rallies, but they were a loosely knit group at the time and weren't really doing anything publicly that we knew of. And we didn't really know who most of them were. Matter of fact, when we started finding out about this, we really started monitoring this as closely as we could, within reason, within the limits of the law. We can't just go out and, like, wiretap somebody or help somebody's working. You can't devote a whole 12-man crew to go follow this one guy and see where he goes for 3 or 4 weeks because there's too many other, more significant crimes going on. But we did monitor as best we could and made connections with my friend Lenny Zeskind, who was I'll talk a lot more about later, really interesting kind of a private undercover Klan fighter. So,
wouldn't you have to really just kind of identify who these people were first?
Right, right.
If they weren't necessarily public or they weren't coming out on a local TV show.
Yeah, it's hard to do.
They're going to meet in private like anybody else that's got things going on. And
it's tough to do. But this Klan show was a focal point that we could monitor and get them to come together and find out who they were.
Like, who's their guest this week?
Yeah, or who showed up to, who's going to run the camera, who's going to run the soundboard. They needed a whole crew just to run the show. So, this kind of sets a scene for the next episode when I'll tell you a little bit about the night we made the Missouri Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and some skinheads came up from Oklahoma, spend a little night on the iron down to jailhouse. We have a term at the time when you're getting ready to arrest somebody. It's Hocus Pocus, 12th and Locust, because the police department sits on the corner of 12th and Locust. So it was going to literally be Hocus Pocus, 12th and Locust for some Klan guys. So we will see you all next time.